This episode of The Y-Files is brought to you by PDS Debt.
On March 29, 1977, George de Morenschild told a journalist that his close friendship with Lee Harvey Oswald was an assignment from the CIA Dallas office. Congress sent an investigator to take a statement. When he got to the house, George's family said he wasn't home. But he was. He was in his bedroom, dead from a shotgun wound. That nobody heard. But the story doesn't start in 1977, and it doesn't start in Dallas. It starts in 1952 in a mansion in Maine, where America's wealthiest families held a séance, and nine people were chosen by ancient gods to change the world. And on November 22, 1963, they did.
Into the William J. LePetitmane Memorial Gambling Casino for the Insane.
Yeah, Ewan, welcome to the grand opening of Fin City, the most exclusive entertainment destination on your property.
On my property?
Yeah, I've converted your house into a full-service casino resort. Gaming, dining, live entertainment. Oh, you'll love the wedding chapel in your bathroom. Very tasteful. Why, it's an ordained minister now.
Since when?
Since I printed the certificate this morning. He's already married six neighborhood cats to each other. $50 a pop.
You can't marry cats to each other?
Tell that to Mr. Whiskers and Senior Fluffington. They registered at PetSmart. Beautiful ceremony. Wyatt cried. Oh, the kitchen's an all-you-can-eat buffet. Shrimp tower, crab cat legs, chocolate fountain, the works.
Great.
It was great until Gertie got in. Ate the whole spread, including the fountain. The actual metal apparatus. I just heard crunching and then silence. Oh, but you're gonna love the live entertainment.
I'm afraid to ask.
The Beaver Brothers Magic Spectacular. Virgil sawed Morgan in half.
Oh, no. Is Morgan okay?
Define okay.
In one piece?
I didn't know. But he's in great spirits. Both halves are.
How much did all this cost?
The marquee sign alone was it.
You built a marquee sign?
I duct taped your TV to the roof. It's scrolling Fin City in neon letters. Very visible from the highway. Curb appeal.
How much?
Let's just say if you dial the cost, you'll reach someone in Sri Lanka.
So you're broke?
Broke is a strong word. I prefer aggressively pre-revenue.
Sounds like you need PDS debt.
Oh, did you just double down? It's today's sponsor.
Sure did.
It starts small. A bill you can't pay, then another. Suddenly your mailbox is full of final notices. Your phone won't stop ringing. You don't answer, but you know who it is. Debt collectors. They want your car, your home, your paycheck, your peace. Debt doesn't wait. It destroys. But there's a way out. PDS Debt has helped hundreds of thousands escape before it was too late. They use AI and data to go beyond the numbers, understand your unique situation, and create a personalized plan. No cookie-cutter solutions, just a clear path to becoming debt-free. And there's no minimum credit score required. Whether your credit is bad or fair, PDS Debt helps you save more, pay off debt faster, and start putting money back in your pocket. They're A-plus rated by the BBB and boast hundreds of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot, proof that PDS Debt is a trusted solution for people who need real help getting out of debt. In fact, the PDS Debt average savings per client for the Y-Files is $22,319. If you're dealing with credit card debt, personal loans, medical bills, or collections, don't wait. PDS Debt has customized options for whatever your situation is. Your savings start the day you complete your assessment, and checking your options is fast, free, and won't impact your credit. Stop living in debt. Get your free 30-second personalized assessment and find the best option for you right now at pdsdebt.com/files.
pdsdebt.com/files.
That's right.
Wonderful. Hey, quick question, completely unrelated. What's the load-bearing capacity of a standard residential chimney? Never mind. Found out.
In 1948, the Cold War got weird. There was the space race, the arms race, and the psychic race. Rumors out of Moscow said Soviet scientists were testing telepathy in labs. If mine could be a weapon, American intelligence wanted one. But there was a problem. No respectable scientist would touch the subject, and Congress was never going to fund seances, at least not publicly. The psychic race needed a man willing to bet his career on it. That man was a 30-year-old doctor from Chicago named Andrea Purich. The Army put Purich through medical school at Northwestern during the war. While he was still a student, Purich published a theory that his colleagues wouldn't go near. He believed the human brain was a radio. Neurons didn't just fire, they transmitted. And anything that could transmit could also receive. If he was right, telepathy wasn't magic, it was biology, and Purich wanted to prove it. He rented a 45-room mansion in Glen Cove, Maine, and started building. He converted one of the rooms into a Faraday cage, a chamber wrapped in copper screen that blocks radio waves and electricity. If the brain is a radio, you test it like a radio. Put a psychic inside a room that no signal can penetrate and see what still gets through. He called the project the Roundtable Foundation of Electrobiology. So the program had a name, a facility, and a testing protocol. The only thing Purich was missing was money. He needed private funding.
Private funding? That reminds me. I need to launch the Kickstarter for my vasectomy.
Just why? You want me to have the cat eat you?
Reward tears. Reward tears. For $10, you can hold the camera. For $50, you can hold the scissors. For $100, you can hold me.
I'll give you $500 to never talk about this again.
$200.
Done. The first check came from Alice Astor Bouverie. Her father was the richest man on the Titanic. He went down with the ship in 1912, and Alice inherited a fortune and an obsession with the afterlife. After that, the donor list read like a who's who of American wealth and power. Business tycoons, heiresses, and of course, politicians. Henry Wallace, Franklin Roosevelt's former vice president, he cut a check. These people sat on corporate boards, advised the White House, and had some ties to the OSS, which became the CIA. Purich tested mediums and clairvoyants from around the world, and most of them disappointed him. Then the Indian philosopher D.G. Vinod took Purich's right ring finger, held it for a minute, and whistled softly.
I held the guy's finger for a full minute. Pull my finger, it's a 2-second transaction. Anything longer, you're dating.
That's not what this was.
He pulled his finger and heard whistling, hello.
Vinod spent the next hour describing private events from Purich's life in perfect detail. The roundtable was now in business. And on New Year's Eve 1952, Vinod laid down inside the testing room. At 9 o'clock, Vinod started talking. It was Vinod's voice, but the words weren't his. The words came from 9 ancient Egyptian gods, and Purich recorded everything. The voice was slow and deliberate, nothing like Vinod's.
We are 9 principles and forces, personalities, if you will.
The voice called itself the Great Ennead, the 9 gods of Heliopolis, worshipped in Egypt for 3,000 years before Christ. And they said they weren't a myth. They were real and physical. And they weren't gods. They were alien minds on a spacecraft watching Earth. The 9 said they controlled the universe and guided all of human history. But they worked through influence, not miracles. A person met someone at the right time. A door opened. A decision looked ordinary until years later when the pattern became visible. Vinod came out of the trance with no memory of what happened. But Purich had dozens of pages of notes, including physics equations that didn't make sense, at least not to him. But he didn't have much time to study his notes, because 6 weeks later, the United States Army recalled Purich to active duty. He went to Edgewood Arsenal in Maryland, where the military tested hypnosis, LSD, and mescaline on soldiers. His orders were to find a drug that enhanced extrasensory perception, psychic research, and mind control, funded by the U.S. military. That summer, he went back to Maine on leave. And on June 27, 1953, under a full moon, he gathered 9 people at the mansion, one for each of the 9 gods. And he picked these people carefully. 8 were wealthy and connected. Purich took the 9th chair for himself. Vinod sat in the middle. At midnight, the 9 returned. And this time they came with a mission. They said the 9 people at the table were chosen to transform human civilization. They didn't answer to any religion or government. They answered to something much older and much more powerful. Then the cotton threads appeared. 9 threads on the floor, 3 feet from Vinod. Nobody saw where they came from.
Oh, they should have checked his belly button.
Whose?
The magic guy. What's his name, Gonad?
Vinod.
Rimrod?
Vinod.
Whatever it is, my money's still on belly button.
There was 1 thread for each person at the table, identical to the sacred thread Hindu Brahmins receive at initiation. The 9 chosen ones picked up the threads and accepted the assignment. Nobody outside that room would have believed a word of it. Purich barely believed it. But 3 years later, a stranger 1,000 miles away sent him a letter that proved the 9 were real. After the session, Vinod returned to India, and the 9 went quiet. When the money ran out, Purich went to Mexico looking for sacred mushrooms to open his mind.
Ah, the classic wellness retreat. My Uncle Irving took the same trip in 74. Left as an accountant, came back as a rain stick guy. Yeah, I can still smell the patchouli. And let me tell you, Uncle Irving looked terrible in a fish bun.
At the hotel, Purich's room was accidentally given to an American couple from Michigan, Dr. Charles Lockheed and his wife. Purich met them. The Lockheed said they were contactees. Space intelligences spoke through them. These were Purich's kind of people, so they kept in touch. A month after Purich came home, a letter from Lockheed arrived. It described a young Arizona contactee, George Hunt Williamson. No connection to Maine. No connection to Purich. He never heard of the roundtable. But somehow Williamson received the same transmission from the Nine on the same nights in 1952 and 1953. Purich still had his doubts, but then he got to the last page. The letter contained the Einstein-Lorentz transformation, the physics equation that describes how time and space distort near the speed of light. Purich recognized it. The Nine spoke the same equation through Vinod. Nobody outside that copper room could have known this. The Nine broadcast the same message to receivers separated by 1,000 miles, through people who never met. After that, Purich stopped doubting. He spent the rest of his life following the instructions from that room. But the Nine were silent. Purich searched for another channel, but every medium he tested came up empty. It took 15 years, but the Nine finally found a vessel worthy of delivering their message. A 24-year-old Israeli paratrooper who could bend spoons with his mind. The call came from Israel. Uri Geller claimed he could read minds and influence events. He said he could bend metal and stop clocks. Purich was skeptical, but witnesses said Geller was the real deal. So Purich flew to Tel Aviv to watch him work. Soon after that, both men were on a plane to America. At his estate in Ossining, New York, Purich launched Operation Lab 9. He built another Faraday cage, had a new medium, and once again asked to speak to the ancient astronaut gods. And this time, they answered. But a different voice came through Geller. It called itself Spectra, a superintelligence aboard a spacecraft 53,000 light-years away. It was still the Nine, but using a new name. And it had new instructions. To complete this new mission, Purich knew he needed help. So he took Geller to the Stanford Research Institute in California, the infamous SRI. Two physicists, Russell Targ and Harold Puthoff, were also experimenting with psychics, specifically remote viewers. SRI was recruiting and training people who project their consciousness anywhere on Earth and beyond. Some of their most talented subjects could even see through time. The first experiments were easier than sending your consciousness to Mars. The subject was given a sealed envelope and asked to draw what was inside. The experiments were conducted in a shielded room, similar to a Faraday cage. Over 7 days in August 1973, Geller made drawing after drawing. One envelope had a picture of grapes, 24 of them. Geller drew 24 grapes. Another image was the solar system. Geller drew that too. Geller got 10 in a row. Impossible odds, witnessed by trained scientists. In October 1974, Targ and Puthoff published their experiments in Nature. This highly respected peer-reviewed journal printed evidence that minds could see through walls. The CIA noticed. They launched a secret program that eventually became Stargate. And for over 20 years, Stargate trained the CIA's psychic spies. And back at Lab 9, the guest list grew. Scientists from SRI, wealthy elites, politicians, even European nobility showed up using fake names. And one of those wealthy elites was British businessman John Whitmore. Whitmore was so impressed with Purich that he wanted to make a movie about the Nine. So they brought in an out-of-work TV writer, Gene Roddenberry. Gene Roddenberry wasn't impressed. He thought the psychics were making it all up. But something must have stuck with him. Because years later, in Deep Space Nine, there's a character named Vinod. The episode is about a cult leader who is protected by a small inner circle.
Season 2, Episode 15, Paradise. The cult leader jams everyone's technology so nobody can leave the planet.
You know the episode number?
Human, I've seen every episode of Star Trek ever. Except the one where they whale, not the whale. Star Trek went down a dark alley, and I could not follow.
Whether Purich was a cult leader could be debated. But he had an inner circle, and they kept receiving instructions from the Nine. Prepare humanity. Get the right people in place. The transformation is coming. One member of the inner circle was Ruth Forbes Payne Young. That Forbes. She was also the great-granddaughter of Ralph Waldo Emerson, Her husband, Arthur Young, made his own fortune when he invented the Bell helicopter. In February 1963, their son Michael Payne was at a dinner party with his wife, also named Ruth. At that party, they became friends with a Russian housewife who spoke almost no English, Marina Oswald. The Paynes didn't know it at the time, but 7 months later, Marina's husband would be sneaking around their garage, hiding a rifle. Before that dinner party could happen, someone had to bring Marina Oswald into that room. In the summer of 1962, Lee Harvey Oswald returned to Texas with a Russian wife, a baby daughter, and a problem. He spent nearly 3 years in the Soviet Union and announced he wanted to give up his American citizenship. And then he changed his mind. The Russian-speaking community in Dallas helped the family at first, but Oswald wore them out with his temper and his politics. One by one, they walked away. But not George de Morenschild. He was a Russian-born aristocrat who became a Texas oil man. He moved in the same wealthy social and diplomatic circles as the Drexels, the Morgans, the Bouviers, and the Kennedys. He also had friends in the U.S. government, specifically the intelligence community. J. Walton Moore was an officer in the CIA's Domestic Contacts Division. They collected information on Americans overseas. After every foreign trip, George sat down with Moore and told him what he saw. In 1962, Moore brought him an assignment, an ex-Marine living in Fort Worth, just back from the Soviet Union. He was perfect for the job. He grew up in Minsk, and Oswald had lived in Minsk for years. Of every man in Dallas, only one can sit across from Lee Oswald and talk about Lenin Avenue stretching to Victory Square, about the river, about the smell of popcorn at the circus. George was actually eager to chat with someone from his hometown, but he wouldn't risk his business or his reputation. Moore said both would be fine. In fact, there was a juicy oil contract in Haiti that could land his way if he helped out the agency. So George de Morenschild, with fresh orders to make a new friend, drove to Fort Worth. And for about 6 months, he ran Oswald's life. He drove him to job interviews. He helped the family find housing. He even stepped into arguments when Lee got violent. And Lee listened to George. On paper, the friendship made no sense. George de Morenschild dined with senators and oil executives. Lee Oswald worked a factory job and read Marx during lunch. But the friendship was real. George liked him. He told people he felt sorry for Lee. He was bright, bitter, and in over his head. He stayed close until February 22, 1963, when he brought the Oswalds to a small party in Dallas. One of the guests was Ruth Payne, a separated mother who studied Russian. Marina needed someone to talk to, and Ruth wanted someone to practice with. By the end of the evening, they exchanged phone numbers. That spring, George de Morenschild left for Haiti and never saw Lee Harvey Oswald again. But he didn't need to. His mission was complete. The CIA's man in Dallas made one introduction, and it was the only one that mattered. The only thing left to do now was wait and watch history unfold. The rifle started in a Chicago mail order warehouse. It ended in a garage in Irving, Texas, wrapped in a blanket, tucked behind camping equipment. Between those 2 points, a chain of introductions ran through one family. Ruth Payne was separated from her husband, Michael, who still paid the mortgage on the house in Irving. Michael worked as a research engineer at Bell Helicopter in Fort Worth. He also held a security clearance. His mother was Ruth Forbes Payne Young, the woman who accepted a cotton thread at a seance in Maine. His stepfather was Arthur Young, the man who designed the Bell Helicopter and signed the checks for Pooridge's research. In September 1963, Ruth Payne packed her station wagon and drove east on a 2-week trip to visit family. One of her stops was her sister Sylvia's house in Falls Church, Virginia. Falls Church is next door to Langley, and Sylvia worked for the CIA. Then Ruth swung south to New Orleans, where the Oswalds were coming apart. Lee was out of work, and Marina was pregnant with their second child. Ruth made her an offer, come live with me in Irving until the baby comes. Marina said yes and moved in permanently, but Lee stayed behind. He only came out on weekends. By that fall, he had almost nothing. His wife and children moved out. He lived in a rented room. He was almost broke. The one thing he owned was wrapped in a blanket in the Payne's garage in Irving. Michael Payne thought it was camping gear. By October, Lee needed work. Ruth made a few phone calls and helped Lee get a job as a warehouse clerk in Dallas. His first day at the Texas School Book Depository was October 16th. That same morning, he was offered a job with an airline. Better work, better pay. He kept the warehouse job at Dealey Plaza. When Kennedy came to Dallas for a motorcade, his route was unknown to the public until November 19th. Lee Oswald had already been at the depository for over a month. On the evening of Thursday, November 21st, Oswald came out to Irving a day early. Marina was surprised, and not in a good way. He played with his daughters outside until dark. Then three times that night, Lee begged her to move back to Dallas. She said no, three times. He went to bed angry. In the morning, he asked her for a kiss, and she turned away. Then, Lee Harvey Oswald was gone. He left his wedding ring on the dresser, and he never took that ring off, not in 2.5 years of marriage. He left $170 in cash, almost everything he had. He did not leave a note. He walked into work carrying a long paper package. A coworker asked what was inside.
Curtain rods.
Oswald said it was curtain rods. It wasn't curtain rods. At 12:29 on November 22, 1963, the presidential motorcade turned from Houston onto Elm Street in Dealey Plaza. Kennedy sat in the back of an open-top Lincoln waving. At 12:30, the shots came. Three rounds. Kennedy slumped over. Governor Connally collapsed in the seat ahead of him. The limousine raced to Parkland Hospital, where doctors pronounced the president dead at 1 o'clock. On the sixth floor of the depository, police found three spent shells, a cardboard box near the window, and a long, empty paper bag. And hidden near the stairwell, a bolt-action 6.5 Carcano rifle that traced directly to Lee Harvey Oswald. And you know the rest of the story. 45 minutes later, Officer J.D. Tippett was shot dead on a sidewalk in Oak Cliff. Police arrested Oswald at the Texas Theater. 2 days later, in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters, a strip club owner named Jack Ruby stepped out of a crowd and shot Oswald on live television. Oswald died at Parkland Hospital. There was no trial, no cross-examination, not one word of testimony from Oswald. But there didn't need to be. He was the shooter, the lone gunman, and that was the end of it. But a murdered president and a murdered suspect left the country full of questions. So 7 days after Dallas, President Lyndon Johnson appointed a commission of seven men to answer those questions, chaired by the Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren. The press called it the Warren Commission. For 10 months, the commission took testimony from hundreds of witnesses. In September 1964, it published its answer, an 888-page report backed by 26 volumes of evidence and one conclusion. Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Case closed, officially. Except the case never closed for the American people. Instead, the questions got louder. Within a few years, most Americans didn't believe the official story, and people spent decades digging into details that the commission ignored. What they found always led back to one house, Michael and Ruth Paines. Marina lived with the Paines. Oswald was there every weekend. He was there the night before the murder. The murder weapon was in their house. Nobody was closer to the Oswald family than the Paines. Ruth Paine became the commission's most valuable civilian witness. She testified longer than almost anyone, and she translated for Marina, who still spoke very little English. Her translations were the backbone of the official story of who Lee Oswald was and what he intended to do that day. The backyard photos, Oswald posing with the rifle and his Marxist newspapers, they came out of Ruth Paine's garage with the rest of the family's belongings. The rifle came out of that same garage, and so did one piece of evidence almost nobody talks about. When Dallas police searched the Paines' house, Detective Gus Rose found a Minox camera loaded with film in Oswald's bag. A Minox is a German spy camera, small enough to hide in the palm of your hand. Intelligence agencies loved them. Warehouse clerks couldn't afford them. The camera was photographed and put into police inventory. Then, the camera disappeared. But something showed up in the FBI's inventory, a Minox light meter. Three times the FBI asked Gus Rose to change the paperwork from camera to light meter. Rose refused every time, and he testified to all this under oath. Reporters asked why the Dallas PD said camera and the FBI said light meter. There wasn't a good answer. So J. Edgar Hoover sent orders to the Dallas office. Find that camera. And the next day, someone did. Michael Paine. The next day, Michael Paine handed the FBI a Minox micro camera. He said it was his and was in the garage the whole time, in a coffee can. Michael said the police weren't interested in a spy camera found in a house occupied by a defector's Russian wife.
This spy camera was in a coffee can? Of course. And right next to the microfilm in a sugar bowl and a cyanide in a spice rack.
And the serial number on Michael's camera had 5 digits. The Minox Corporation said their cameras had 6 digits. And the serial number's important. It's how Minox could trace a camera's manufacture date and origin. A 5-digit number makes it untraceable. The Warren Commission had the Paynes under oath for days. Nobody asked them one question about that camera. The rifle, the photos, the translations, the spy camera, and the job that put Oswald in that window. Every one of those things ran through Ruth Paine's house. Even Oswald's mother said she believed both Marina and Ruth Paine were involved. Somehow the family at the center of the evidence was never treated as part of the case. And here's the thing. The FBI was already looking at the Paines. Twice in the weeks before the assassination, an agent stopped by. He was keeping tabs on the defector's wife who lived there. The Bureau had a file open on Lee Harvey Oswald before a single shot was fired. So when the shots came, every phone line that touched Oswald's world became a live wire, and the FBI started listening. On the afternoon of the assassination, Michael Paine called Ruth from work. He said he felt sure Oswald killed the president, but he didn't feel Oswald was responsible. And then came the next sentence.
We both know who is responsible for the assassination.
When commission lawyers asked Michael about this, he denied saying it. And the call never appeared in the Warren Report. It was reduced to a few sentences in an FBI file called Commission Document 206. And in that file, the source was redacted. The names of the people on the call were redacted. Just a male voice and a female voice. The phone numbers were not identified. For more than a decade, we both know who was responsible. That quote only lived in that buried report. When the files were opened in the 1970s, it was revealed that it was, in fact, Michael and Ruth Paine on that call. Something else was missing from the Warren Report. In all 26 volumes, all 888 pages, Poor Rich, The Round Table, and The Nine didn't appear once. But they should have. The seance world was closer to the commission than anyone knew. One of the 7 commissioners was former director of the CIA and longtime villain on this channel, Alan Dulles. Dulles should not have been on that commission for a few reasons. One, Kennedy fired him. After the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy said he wanted to, quote, shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. He believed Dulles wanted to drag the U.S. into a war with Cuba, which they tried over and over. So Dulles was out. And there's another reason Dulles had no business being on the commission. He had a secret. During the war, he ran a spy in Switzerland, Mary Bancroft. She was his agent, and she was his mistress. And for more than 40 years, Mary Bancroft's best friend was Ruth Forbes Paine Young. They traveled together, they vacationed together.
Hold on. The commissioner's spy girlfriend's best friend is the seance lady whose son had the rifle in his garage.
Those are the facts.
Ugh, I've seen tighter plots and vertical dramas.
You watch those?
Guilty pleasure. Hate is welcome.
While Dulles sat on the commission, Bancroft wrote him a letter reminding him how well she knew Michael Paine's mother. That letter wasn't in the report either. It was found 40 years later. The man Kennedy fired had the files on the family that housed this killer, the files on the family of his mistress's best friend. And 14 years later, someone started burning the files. On September 5th, 1976, George de Morenschild wrote a letter to the director of the CIA begging for help. He said vigilantes surrounded his family. Their phone was tapped. They were followed everywhere.
Either FBI is involved in this, or they do not want to accept my complaints. We are driven to insanity by the situation. I tried to write, stupidly and unsuccessfully, about Lee H. Oswald, and must have angered a lot of people. I do not know. But to punish an elderly man like myself and my highly nervous and sick wife is really too much. Could you do something to remove the net around us?
The director read the letter, and he recognized the name. His prep school roommate was de Morenschild's nephew. And in de Morenschild's own address book, there was an entry for an old friend. Bush, George H.W., Poppy. The director of the CIA was George Bush. Bush's staff asked how well he knew the writer. Bush said he knew the man since the 1940s. Then in a memo, he added a strange sentence.
I do know this man, De Morenschild. I don't recall his role in all this.
I don't recall his politician for... I recall vividly, but not until I have counsel present.
And Bush wrote back to George De Morenschild.
In your situation, I can well imagine how the attentions you described in your letter affect both you and your wife. However, my staff has been unable to find any indication of interest in your activities on the part of federal authorities in recent years. I can only speculate that you may have become newsworthy again in view of the renewed interest in the Kennedy assassination, and thus may be attracting the attention of people in the media.
2 months after that, George tried to take his own life. 4 times. His wife got so scared that she had him committed. Doctors put him through electroshock therapy and released him at the end of 1976. In March 1977, journalist Edward Epstein went to Palm Beach to interview him. They met at the Breakers Hotel for breakfast. That's when George finally admitted his CIA contact, J. Walton Moore, put him on Oswald.
I would never have contacted Oswald in a million years if Moore had not sanctioned it. Too much was at stake.
The friendship was real. The assignment was too. They took a break for lunch. Epstein went back to his room. They were scheduled to pick things back up at 3. That same morning, congressional investigator Gaetan Fonzie drove to George's house.
His name is Fonzie?
Yep.
Cool name.
George wasn't home. Fonzie left his card with George's daughter.
Hey!
George came back at 2. He saw the card and went upstairs. Almost 40 minutes later, his daughter found him. He apparently shot himself with a shotgun. But 6 people were in that house, and not one of them heard a shotgun go off. But a maid had a tape recorder going. She was recording a soap opera. On the tape, you hear a single blast at 2:21, then the sound of a gun hitting the floor. And George wasn't the only witness connected to JFK who turned up dead, or didn't turn up at all. Chicago mob boss Shem Giancana was shot in his kitchen before he could testify about the CIA's plots against Castro. Mobster Johnny Roselli went missing and turned up in an oil drum. And ex-cop Richard Kane was linked to the mob and the CIA. He was also killed in Chicago, in a sandwich shop. Hale Boggs was a congressman on the Warren Commission. He publicly criticized the Warren Report and called for a new investigation in the 1970s. He disappeared in a small plane over Alaska in 1972. The wreckage was never found. And a year and a half after Palm Beach, the Lab 9 estate burned down. Decades of poor Rush's files went up with it, along with the family dog. He didn't talk to the police, but later he wrote he believed it was the CIA. Then Poor Rich went into hiding. He died in 1995 after a fall down a staircase. By the end of the 1970s, the JFK witnesses were all dead, and everyone in Poor Rich's world lost their jobs, their reputations, and their funding. Some people lost their minds. Every person in the Council of Nine, and every person who could name them, was gone. This is one of the stories where the true parts are strange enough without any help. So let's separate what happened from what didn't. The seances happened. The round table was real, and so was that donor list. Burrich's assignment to find a drug that enhances ESP is true. The Nine are a different story. Everything from inside that copper room comes through one man. The aliens, the predictions, the equations, nobody else saw any of it. And Burrich didn't write about it until 1974. After JFK, after the Warren Report, after the Paines got famous. Either 9 aliens predicted history, or one man made up a story to claim a piece of it. Now, Geller's 10 for 10 really happened, in front of witnesses, but he's been controversial for years. But the CIA wrote about him that he demonstrated his paranormal perceptual ability in a convincing and unambiguous manner. But that wasn't good enough to keep Stargate running. The program was eventually shut down because it wasn't yielding valuable results. But that's also being debated. What happened at Dallas is different. There are records, there are witnesses, there's connections. A lot of connections. Too many connections to explain away as coincidence. Lee Harvey Oswald got a job at Dealey Plaza over a month before the president's route was announced. That's either a coincidence or he knew something. Now, I lean toward he knew something, but until we have all the JFK files, all we can do is speculate, which we love to do. Now, it's true that everything ran through Ruth Paine's house. but she was never charged. And she said for 60 years, she was just helping a friend. She's still around today, and she sticks by that story, and please leave her alone. The spy camera turned up in the FBI's own files. Then it became a light meter. The police receipt says camera, and FBI signed it. The property clerk admitted he changed the paperwork when the Bureau asked him to, and Hoover's teletypes about this still exist. Skeptics will say the camera appears on the Friday list, but the bag wasn't searched until Saturday. Maybe someone confused a camera case for a camera. But a camera case doesn't hold film, and Gus Rose opened it and found a roll inside. He said so under oath, and he never wavered. None of it makes anyone a spy, but it's one more thing that ran through that garage that got rewritten on paper. That phone call happened. The Warren Report didn't have much to say about it, and without an actual recording, Michael Payne is innocent until proven guilty. But it's another uncomfortable detail. George de Morenschild confessed, but he was dying, and he was paid for his story, so the confession is not solid. But he was a CIA informant. At the time, J. Walton Moore denied that. But the classified files show George really was reporting to the CIA. The CIA denied a lot of things about JFK, and they still do. I don't think George was killed, but the uncomfortable connections are there. Dulles is the real problem with all of this. His mistress's best friend was all over the story and was never investigated. That's not a confession, but it proves the Warren Report was incomplete at best and corrupt at worst. And everything flows from that. Dulles should have never been on that commission, and I'll never stop saying it. Dead mobsters happen. Were they connected to JFK? Maybe. Was the mob connected to the CIA? Absolutely. But the one death that should bother you is the dead congressman. The guy from the commission, Hale Boggs. His plane vanished over Alaska. Now that's a place where planes vanish, but it would be nice to have some closure on that. But no wreckage, no closure. Purich's house really was set on fire while he was away. His kids were home, but they got out in time. Their dog was really killed. And his notes were lost, but he published before the fire. So here's what we're left with. An ordinary explanation. Wealthy families are connected. They're connected with each other, with the government, and with the intelligence community. Wealthy people cluster.
Oh, sure, they cluster around seances, the CIA, and the guy who shot the president. My poker buddies cluster around TV, warm light beer, and somebody's wife's meatballs.
You have a point, but correlation is not conspiracy.
Yeah, and it ain't exculpatory either, counselor. Clearing someone of guilt.
I know what it means! But that doesn't explain the pattern. The same people kept appearing around psychic research, military money, the Paynes, Oswald, and the CIA. I didn't even get into the Maury Island UFO connection to JFK, but I have a whole episode on that. More names like Fred Crisman and Guy Bannister. More people connected to New Orleans. All connected to the CIA. All connected to the mob and the death of a president. Coincidences are not a conspiracy, until they are. The alien gods weren't real. The nine people were. They had the money, the connections, and the power to change the world. And nobody could prove they didn't. There are people out there right now sitting around a table, deciding who lives and who dies, deciding which elected leaders are inconvenient, deciding what stories you're allowed to hear. It doesn't matter if you're a mobster, a strip club owner, or the president of the United States. If you become a problem, you go away. But nobody at a table like that thinks they're a villain. They think they're chosen. A god, a flag, a voice in the dark. Something always gives powerful people permission. And once they have it, the ordinary rules don't apply to them. The people at the table change, but there's never an empty seat. Thank you so much for hanging out today. My name is AJ. You know Hagglefish.
Word to the wise. If your new best friend speaks fluent Minsk and keeps driving you to job interviews, ask your dad for the gas.
This has been The Wyatt Files. If you had fun or learned anything, he'd appreciate it if you could subscribe. I don't care, but he really wants you to like, subscribe, comment, and share. That stuff really makes his fins tingle. Like most topics we cover on the channel, today's is recommended by you. If there's a story you want to see or learn more about, go to thewyattfiles.com/tips. Send me an email. Catch us on Discord, in the comments. You'll find, you know where we are. If you enjoy the stories I tell here on The Wyatt Files, check out my other show on the channel. It's called The Basement. It's a conversation show where I chat with the interesting people behind these episodes. Some of them you know, but a lot of them you don't. But they're all people I find fascinating. Experts on topics like the moon landing hoax, or it was real, the JFK conspiracy, DMT laser code was a good one, Precognition with Eric Wargo is one of my favorites. Mark D'Antonio was here last week. Mr. Ballin was in. It's random, but it's a lot of fun. And for someone you'd like to see on the show, let me know. I'm always looking for good guests. Remember, you can also listen to The Y-Files as a podcast. Take us on the road. I upload at least twice a week episodes, campfire stories, interviews. You can find it by looking for The Y-Files Operation Podcast. I was short of time. I needed a name that seemed to make sense. Anyway, it's there. It's available everywhere you get your podcasts. If you need more Y-Files in your life, see a doctor. Find a date. Go outside. Touch grass. I'm just kidding. If you need more Y-Files in your life, and who doesn't? Make sure you check out our 24/7 stream on the Y-Files backstage. Link down below. Over there, we run episodes back-to-back, some fun content in between, and the live chat is more entertaining than anything I could produce. Special thanks to our patrons who made this channel possible. Every episode of the Y-Files is dedicated to my Patreon members. I couldn't do any of this without your support. Some of you have been here for years, and I thank you for that. And if you'd like to support the channel, keep us going, and join this amazing community, for as little as $3 a month, you get access to perks like seeing videos early with no commercials, exclusive merch, and 2 private live streams every week just for you. And the whole Y-Files team is on the stream, not just my mug. You get to see Victoria, Jen, Gino, Hybrid, sometimes Mary Jane is on there. And the same usual suspects show up. When I do live streams, there's thousands of people in there. It's hard to be heard. Over on Patreon, there's a few dozen of us, maybe sometimes 100. And you get to talk. You can turn on your webcam, hop up on stage, ask a question, talk about anything you like. I think it's a great way to get to know us as people. Another way to support the channel is grab something for the Y-Files store.
Grab a heck of a t-shirt. Oh, my fist. I'm off your mind. You can stick your fist into it before the CIA takes it. Oh, get it, honey. Set my face on it. I'll get one of these adorable squeezy animal enemies.
But if you're going to buy merch, make sure you become a member on YouTube. I know, more money. It's worth it, I promise. Because YouTube members get 10% off everything in the Y-Files store forever, and it's only $3 a month. So if you're going to spend $40 on t-shirts, Fistable coffee mugs, challenge coins, hecklefish plushies. If you're going to spend $40, become a member, get the code, it pays for itself, and then just cancel. I don't mind. That thing is there to save you money. It doesn't make me any money. I give all that revenue to the great team.
Yeah, keep that secret down in the sack, Dwayne.
Those are the plugs, and that's going to do it. Oh, my voice is hoarse. I'm not going to know until I look at this in the edit. How long was Bubba back there? You guys see a black and white kitten up there? That was Bubba Boy. I'm not redoing it. He's staying in. Welcome to the channel, pal. Until next time, be safe, be kind, and know that you are appreciated. Bubs! Where are you, Bubs?
In Area 51, a secret code inside the Bible said I was. I love my UFOs and paranormal fun, as well as music, so I'm singing like I should. But then another conspiracy theory becomes the truth, my friends, and it never ends. No, it never ends. The crap cat and got stuck inside Mel's hole with MK Ultra. I've been only too aware. Did Stanley Kubrick fake the moon landing alone on a film set, or were the shadow people there? The Roswell aliens just fought the smiling man, I'm told, and his name was Cold. And I can't believe I'm dancing with the Hecklefish on Thursday nights with AJ2 and Y-Files up and all through the night. All I ever wanted was to just hear the truth, so the Y-Files on repeat all through the night.
secret city underground. Mysterious number stations, planet Serpo 2, Project Stargate, and what the Dark Watchers found. We're in a simulation, don't